Oh man. Okay, so this past week, before I dashed off to with Tyrion to this Edmonton Folk Festival, I started back up at the university at Booth, and they've got some spring courses, summer courses going on there right now, and so I was involved in leading a gathering with some folks that are taking those courses there. And as part of that gathering, I shared some reflections on compassion, sort of worked with the material that I'd been working with already in our community, right? Some of those ideas. As part of that, one part of what I talked about was a story that I'd shared last week about the Sangers and their whole, that blessing sticky note, pay it forward, buy a piece of pizza when you buy your own piece of pizza, and that whole thing. So I shared that story with this gathering. And then right after this gathering, I had a meeting with the university president, some planning things we were doing. And she'd been at the gathering, and when we sat down together, she said, "The story you told reminded me of another story from her own life." And she had been, it was a work thing, she'd in Mumbai. She'd never been to Mumbai. She hasn't been since, but this occasion, whatever it was, she didn't elaborate, but she was there for work. And she had one free day, like a day to see Mumbai. Anyway, so a world city. So she spent the day with someone, someone she didn't know, but someone that a colleague had said, "This person will show you around Mumbai and show you the sights." And she came back, and her colleague said, "What was your day like? What was the experience like?" And she said, she told him, she said, I was so struck by how everywhere I went today, people looked me right in the eye and said, "How can I help you?" And she said, "It didn't feel transactional. Like, it didn't feel like a business question. It wasn't like, asking how I can help you is good for the bottom line, so I'm going to be, professionally helpful. We all encounter this, right? And it's not a bad thing." But this wasn't that. This was like, this, there was something else going on. And it had really struck her. And her colleague just lit up. And he said, "Oh, I'm so glad that was your experience. Because we believe," and he was speaking sort of for himself and his tradition, he was Hindu. He said, "We believe that when we look at another person, we're seeing God. When I say, 'Can I help you?' to another human, I'm saying that to God. How can I, what can I, God, what can I do for you?" Essentially, to put it into vernacular a little more. And Dr. Kerr said to me, she said, and it, she's from a Christian tradition, maybe that's a little self-evident as the president of a Christian university, but she said, "Why is it that in my tradition, in the Christian tradition, that is so often not what is enacted?" And then we had a whole conversation about ways in which Christianity has stripped that idea away from everyone who doesn't believe what that tradition believes and does not see them as bearers of God unless they believe the right things. It's a really interesting conversation. That question, what is it about the way we practice Christianity that feels like we don't do that? We don't look at other humans and see God. To me, as somebody for whom that is also my rooted tradition, that feels like a really important question to me. Like, what's wrong? What's wrong with my tradition that this thing does not seem to naturally be the thing that happens in it and out of it? That's a problem. I shared this community before what it was like for me to grow up in northern Saskatchewan. Lots about that growing up experience that was lovely and good. One of the less good parts of it was that I grew up in and around what now looks to me like rampant racism. There were basically two colors of people in the town where I grew up. There were white people and there were brown people. At that point in history, pretty much all the brown people were indigenous folks. And so I grew up surrounded by these them and us narratives. And those narratives allowed me to be dismissive. They allowed me to be dismissive not just of a people group, which is, I think, relatively easy, but also of individual people. Even when I saw them having experiences that, when I look back on them, I wish what had they would have elicited in me was a broken heart or a compassion response that said, "How can this heartbreak be my heartbreak? How is this heartbreak already my heartbreak? How can I join it?" Instead of just being able to dismiss it. But I grew up surrounded by narratives that allowed me to be dismissive. of a people group and of individual people within that group. They were, fill in the blank. I'm not going to restate the stereotypes. They're just not, they don't bear repeating. But how that sentence got ended allowed me to stay in my bubble. The upshot of it was that I could live with the belief that that was not my problem. In fact, I could live so deeply in that bubble that it wasn't until years later that it occurred to me that thinking the way that I did about people not like me, and also being taught that the way of Jesus was a way of love, was not just two things that were in complex relationship. Those were two things that were in thoroughly, utterly disordered relationship. They were sick, to use medical parlance for the nature of that relationship. They were just wrong, the way they sat together. I'm still working at unraveling that. I probably will be for the rest of my life. I think what started to shift my thinking, though, was when I left that community to go to a boarding school. Anyway, I chose to go to a boarding school, so this is not that story. Which was in grade 11. And I was there for 2 years for my high school senior years. And it wasn't until I went away to a boarding school and I had a dorm mate that became a friend before I realized they were indigenous, that I started to think about this differently. And I realized on some reflection that it was partly because I got to know them first of all as a human. I got to know them first of all as a fellow student. I got to know them first of all as a fellow teenager who was living away from home for the first time. This was a guy who liked rock and roll and dirt bikes and, you know, high school girls. So we had a lot in common. All the important things, really. Basically, this was a person that I experienced as being like me.
I don't know why I just love milk.
And I suppose...
I love that milk.
I love that bell, too. That bell has a story. We can talk about that another time. We just need to listen to this because it's so crazy. I could tell that whole story about this friendship with this guy as though it was a good thing, right? And I think in lots of ways it was. But there are other ways that it was just me naively staying inside of my preferences, because this guy was at the same school as me, he seemed to be from the same social strata as me, we had similar values, at least on the surface, and so on. So there's a whole bunch of ways in which that was just an easy thing that happened. And in the years since then, I realized that that experience with that high school classmate was just my version of something that lots of us probably have in common with many, many people these days. It's relatively easy to be judgmental or dismissive in the absence of relationship. That's pretty simple. We can sort of stay inside of our idea bubbles in that situation. We can stay inside spaces that are reinforced by constant inputs from those that we regard as being like us. Safe, easy to be with, however we kind of casually or even deliberately form our human bonds. If we stay with those kind of, in those kind of spaces, it's pretty easy to accept the people in those spaces. We touched on this last week a little bit. I mentioned Paul Bloom's book, Against Empathy, and his observation in that book that our strong built-in biases tend to move us to empathize with those we perceive as attractive, those we think of as like us or innocent in a situation. And compassion, so that's empathy. Compassion, Bloom points out, is something that calls us to care for those we perceive as not like us. That actually defines compassion as distinct from empathy. The bias toward action and the bias toward action that joins the suffering of those not like us. That's compassion. Empathy is feeling what other people are feeling, so that they're distinct from one another in that way. And I think if I'd taken a little bit more time to learn a bit of this high school classmate's story, which I eventually did, I might have found the whole thing a lot more challenging, and I might have gone a lot deeper into it, and I might have gotten a lot more from it, which is not the reason to do those things, but I think that would have happened. Because what I learned when I started to get to know their story is that they had been taken from their family as a very small child, something we now are familiar with, right? There's an entire systematic thing that happened around that. They got caught up in that. They had been taken from their family and their culture of origin, and they had been moved from place to place for years. They had eventually landed in a home where they experienced some love and some belonging and some stability, and as part of that ended up at the same school as me. But for all of that, they were not like me in some ways that, had I been aware of them, had I paid attention to them, would have started to raise really troubling questions for me about my own upbringing, about my own religious education and my own spiritual formation, about my own sort of blithe acceptance of what was really an unsupportable gap between what I was being taught about the nature of the divine and divine love and the way that I was relating to my fellow human beings. I think I would have been in that swamp way sooner if I had been engaging with compassion in my world as an adolescent. It's not our default setting, right? Compassion is such a costly idea. It's such a deep call. It's not our default setting. It's a hard idea. As it turns out, my radar these days is tuned to race relations kind of more acutely than it used to be. And so lots of the stories I'm telling today are on that topic generally. But if I reflect on it further, I realize that I have similar experiences that are analogous to this with people with whom I have differences of religion, with whom I am different in gender or in sexuality, with whom I have different socioeconomic status, with whom I do not share political ideology, and so on. You know, we could kind of keep going right down the list of the biggies, ways in which we perceive difference. Them and us, as it turns out, really gets in the way of caring for my fellow human beings. Like, big time. Turns out that it doesn't just get in the way of caring well for my fellow human beings, it turns out that it gets in the way of caring well for the earth that we share, for the bedrock longings that we share, for the desires, for the heartaches, for the delights. I heard an indigenous person this past weekend explain land acknowledgements in a way that I'd never heard before, and it was so beautiful. I got knocked over all weekend by the beautiful spirit of the indigenous people of not just this continent first, but other continents as well. Just like floored. Anyway, this particular explanation, which was offered among other things by a two-spirited indigenous person, not an easy space to live in, was that a land acknowledgement is not just a way of saying kind of we were here first, and you know, if we hadn't been here and already knew what we were doing, none of you guys would have survived. Like, it's, and by the way, it's still our land. That, he says, that's not it. Like, that's not what a land acknowledgement is. I mean, those details are in there and they're not unimportant. But at the core of a land acknowledgement is actually a way of saying we, humans, have this life because we have this earth. This is our shared inheritance. This is our home. This is our home. It was like a working definition of grace. It just poured out of this person. The memory is stunning. The experience just decked me. I went to bed that night and I went, that was a great day. Why am I so exhausted? Oh yeah. Because my spirit's been just like in hyperdrive all day. Them and us just flat out gets in the way of all of that. We frame those kinds of things that I just mentioned, how we engage with our ecological reality, how we talk about our longings, how we talk about our delights and our desires, and all of those things. We frame them differently as cultures. And one of the reasons we do that, of course we do that. So this is not about, this is not about all the colors becoming one, culturally speaking. This is not about all the cultures becoming one bland vanilla. I'm going to use vanilla because I'm vanilla. One bland vanilla culture. This is not the goal. It's about making what we make, because we will make culture. Like, we can't not. It's just what we do, right? We are, I think I've used this phrase before. Of all that is alive, we are the only species that makes worlds of the earth. Like, and I'm not talking, I'm not, that's not in denial of other parts of the ecological complexity or animal kingdom's complexity. But when we make, the cultural thing we make is unique to us as humans. We will make culture. And we will make it in context. We don't have another way. So we can't actually make culture without context. We're just not capable of it. We're capable of quite complex context, and we're capable of bringing things into our context in a limited way, but we can't make culture without context. So, all to say, we are going to define those kinds of things like desires, longings, delights, values, all that kind of, we're going to define those things differently because we're going to make them in context. But what's running underneath all of that, if we even just scratch the surface a little bit, is this is what we do as human beings. We have this making of worlds in common, even if the details of the worlds we make are different. So now we're getting closer to breath. Now we're getting closer to having something essential and undeniable that is about life in common. And if you think about the religious stories we make when we make culture, they're about life, right? They are about the way life works. They're about the way life maybe continues to work after the part of it that we experience in an embodied way ends. They're about the way the parts of life that we can't figure out work, the mysteries. So we're all making stories about this. And by the way, if we make a story that says, that is atheistic, that says there is no deity, that's the same story. Like, we're dealing with the same thing when we make that story, as if we make a story that says there's a God and they have a name and they're personal and I talk to them and they talk to me. We're trying to solve the same problem. We're trying to make something about the same thing. We're not making the same thing, but we're trying to address the same human thing when we do that. So when we start to think about it that way, it doesn't make our story less precious, but it makes it really, really hard to weaponize the story, because it's not the bottom layer. So when I think back to Dr. Kerr's question about why is it in the Christian tradition that this thing that she experienced with the Hindu tradition that particular day, why is it that that doesn't seem to happen? The simple answer is because somewhere along the line, a bunch of Christians made a version of that story that said, you're actually not fully human until you believe what I believe. You are a savage. You are a heathen. You are my neighbor but a project. Mm-hmm. You are, like, you know, pick a layer, right? But either way, you're not fully human. Because God's not alive in you. Why? Because you didn't accept Jesus into your heart. Don't you know how this works?
Yeah.
See? You're fired. No, I'm kidding. So we know how this works. Like, lots of us in this room know this version of the story, right? But we don't tend to think about it that way. We're not taught to think about it that way when we're taught it. I wasn't taught to think about it that way. But it enabled me to look at my indigenous brothers and sisters like they weren't me. That story did that. It's not supposed to do that. That's not why it's there. And the people that taught me that story knew that that's not why that story was there. But we weren't making the connection yet. One of the reasons was because to make that connection means I have to think of my religious traditional story as not the only one that's valid. And that's a big maneuver. Because most of us, not just in Christian tradition, but in other religious traditions as well, we're often taught that that story is the answer. It's not a story that addresses these things. It's the answer to those things. In an exclusive, tribal, you have to come over the line to get in sort of way. But if we start to think about that story making as the thing that we're made to do, so it really matters. This could all sound like the diminishment of all those stories at first blush, and it's just not. It actually elevates them, I think. But you start from a different place. If we start to think of those stories as the thing that we have been given the job of making, and that we're actually called to make sorts of stories when we're making culture, when we're making religions, among other things, we're called to make the sort of stories that are at their baseline about love, not exclusivity. And we start to ask ourselves, now what kind of stories would we tell that would tell that story to everybody? We get to make stories that heal. We get to make stories that restore. We get to make stories that liberate. And we get to live into those stories. And when we live into those stories, we are living into the mystery for which we use the language of God in the tradition that I grew up in. And so I can sit at the Edmonton Folk Festival and I can listen to my Indigenous sister who busted out this rhyme in the middle of a jam session that I'm not from a charismatic tradition, but I was like, I was carried away by that. Like, whatever language I would use for the presence of the divine, I would use for what was going on right there, right then. What happens is that the funnel of possibility just starts to do this as you go through the world. And all of a sudden, you're surrounded. We're surrounded. We're like swimming in the stories that humanity has made to try to address these things that just nag at us, that just make us go, how does that work? And we're with a bunch of other people on the planet who are doing the same thing, and we get to sit with them and hear them tell us about the story that they made to peek in on the mystery of the divine. And we can say, my story peeks in a different window. My story turns over a different rock. But guess what? None of these stories exhaust that mystery. So the idea that there's like this one thin red line of story that deals with all these things, it's untenable. It's unsupportable. It just doesn't hold up. And not only that, it gets in the way of me loving other human beings and caring well for our shared inheritance of the earth and being able to hear them tell their God story and know that I am in the presence of the divine. And I'm a Christian. And those things are not incompatible. Unless my version of the Christian story says, unless you're in this version of the story, you're subhuman. In which case, we got a really, really big problem. None of that was in my notes. It's just what's going on inside. So there you go. Maybe it's because I'm in my own house. Anyway. And there's a weird concept. My house, my land. Got to rethink that too. All of this makes me curious, among other things, about the experiences in the room. So as I seriously struggle with the ways in which my religious upbringing was in conflict with seeing God and all the people around me, I would be curious to hear some things from the people in the room about what your experiences have been with that. With what's it like to look at another human being that's not like you and sort of address yourself internally or maybe in conversation to the question about where's God in this exchange? Where's the divine in this exchange? In this person, in their culture, in their ideas? And what's that been like? I'm going to turn off the recording now because that's the way this works. And so if you're listening to the podcast, go find another human and talk to them.